Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. When a personal journal is written, it is often not meant for the eyes of anyone but the writer. Yet when a stranger's journal is read, the reader often becomes a voyeur of the innermost secrets of another. And whether it is the true journal of another or fiction, who cares? It often remains a good story. Lynn Freed, originally from Durban, South Africa, has written the fictional journal of Agnes LaGrange entitled The Mirror, which reveals the thoughts, feelings, and loves of Agnes, starting when she arrived in South Africa to work as a housekeeper and ending 50 years later. I spoke with Lynn Freed in December of 1997 from her home in rural Northern California and asked her, who is Agnes LaGrange?
Agnes LaGrange is a character who came to me, and I don't generally make this kind of claim for my fiction, but anyway, she did arrive, at least she arrived by way of her voice, in a situation that I was writing a short story around, which is the arrival of a young English woman, working class English woman, to South Africa in 1920 to work as a housekeeper, really a glorified maid, for a family of Lithuanian Jews, in the process of which she has an affair with the old man and starts, as she puts it, making her way in the world. Anyway, I had this situation in mind to write about, and once I came to write about it, her voice was just there, and I wrote a short story around this, a very short one, which actually constitutes the first chapter and was published in Harper's I can't remember when, a couple of years ago. And then when I was moving on to start writing a novel, it was her voice that was still with me, and I took her along into the novel, and that's how it began, really, and that's how I came to this character, whom I suppose, like all characters, including dogs and cats, is an aspect of oneself, but she's not me. Sometimes I wish she were, but she isn't.
And you present this character in a voyeuristic way. When one looks at the mirror, it's like one is picking up another person's journal, Agnes's journal, and you go into the intimacy of her life and her thoughts.
Right. Yes. And once I had her voice, and it was a voice really like a spoken journal voice, or somebody who is writing in a journal, it does have that feeling of voyeurism, which of course ties in with the mirror motif, which I tried not to, and I hope did not, overplay in the novel. This is a young woman who's actually never seen an image of herself at the beginning of the novel and is given a full-length mirror by her employer in which she sees herself for the first time and falls in love with herself. And through the mirror, she comes to an understanding of herself as a woman, her sexual prowess and her other kinds of prowess. But anyway, it does fit with this kind of, as you would say, voyeuristic feel to the read of the novel, which is also added to, by the way, that Crown published the novel as a journal. It looks like a journal. It holds in the hand like a journal. It's got old photographs included in it. So it has a kind of a memoir feel to it, which is just exactly what I intended.
Are these photographs yours?
No, some of them are mine. Some of them I got from old family photographs and so forth, but the bulk of them were obtained from the local history museum in Durban.
The characters in the novel, very few of them have names. Many of them are characters, the hunter, the tycoon, the newspaper man who was her husband, but he's nameless in the novel.
Right. I didn't actually think this through as I was writing it. The newspaper man came as such because before she knew his name, presuming she did, she thought of him as the newspaper man. They were both residents in a rather run-down hotel near the railway. And then she happened to marry him, and somehow it seemed right that he remained in her consciousness as the newspaper man. She never really had an intimate relationship with this man. And then somehow that's the way she seemed to consider all men, I think. And by the way, there's also a woman who's never named, the mother-in-law. But I've heard a lot from women who've read this novel, and they've said, you know, good Lord, this is so often the way women consider men. I don't think men really understand that. There's been a lot of literature from men about how they feel about women, which is really just this way.
What do you mean?
What I mean is that women are seen as what they stand for. By the way, I didn't think of any of this while I was writing it. It just seemed that this was the kind of woman who would think of a man as a newspaper man, a hunter, a banker, a tycoon. But in fact, I'm sorry, I'm at a loss to think of an example, but something may come as we talk, of fiction that's written about men, say Don Juan types. She is not the equivalent, but men who've had several women, in which the women really are not who they are, but what they are, what they represent to that particular man on his quest for self-knowledge, one would hope.
An object instead of a person?
Yes. I don't give it any judgment here or otherwise, but yes, I think that you could say that.
In your personal experience, you're a native of Durban, South Africa.
Right.
What do you draw on for painting the picture in the mirror?
I draw on that deep memory that somehow miraculously tends to come to one when one is writing fiction properly, and somehow eludes one when one is struggling and cannot get it right. In this case, it was a territory I knew well in another era, which is namely, you know, the era that I grew up in, 50s, 60s, 70s and on. But it was so evident to me as I was writing this that, and I was using a lot of visual aids. I used a lot of architectural histories, histories of Durban and so forth, just to see the way people dressed, the way they looked, the way the place looked. It wasn't difficult. I had never even thought of writing any kind of historical fiction, and I wouldn't really think of this as historical fiction as such, but until I wrote this, and once I was doing it, it was really quite easy. Then with the second draft and so forth, I checked up on the fact. And I just had a letter, in fact, last week, from a 90-year-old woman who lives in Philadelphia, who grew up in Durban in the 30s and said I had got it exactly right, and so it was pleasing to me, really pleasing.
Really? That must be.
Yeah.
That must be. When you draw on the deep memory of your background, is there a way of sparking that or turning on the lights in that memory so that it can drop out of the tip of your pencil?
I don't know what to say. You know, I teach writing every now and then, and this is a question that students often ask because of course it's the situation one wants to be in when one's writing fiction, and it's a situation one can't get into when one is blocked from writing fiction or anything else. I think really what brings the deep memory is sitting down and writing, struggling with it until you have the voice right, and the character that comes with the voice, and the situation that comes with the character that has the voice, and then somehow one is in the territory of the fiction. One has to inhabit the fiction, the territory of one's fiction, in order to have it live on the page. And I don't think this is something that you can wish onto the page. It's something you have to work for. And then it sort of comes to you. I can't remember who it was. I think it was Thucydides who said, inspiration visits you while you're firmly seated at your desk. And I think that is indeed the case.
And that is when the voice resounds?
Yes. If you're lucky. I mean, there are many things that one writes and fails at. But if you get it right, if it is a territory which you can inhabit or colonize, whichever metaphor works for you, and of which you're not afraid, then I think the fiction has a chance. But there are so many ineffable things that are involved in the writing of fiction that it's very hard to pinpoint, say, just the territory of the fiction or just the character or just the voice. It's a kind of a confluence that has to happen if the fiction's going to be right. And if it's wrong, you have to call on years and years of craft to fix the bits where it doesn't exactly flow, because of course it doesn't most of the time. most of the time one's fixing.
You've made a point of saying that Agnes LaGrange is not Lynn Freed, that this is not at all autobiographical.
Well, I wouldn't say not at all autobiographical, because in fact everything one writes, I think, is autobiographical. It comes through one's consciousness. But this is a character who, if she has any connection with me, is an aspect of myself, much as if one is writing a play, for instance. Every character on the stage is an aspect of oneself or an aspect of one person. So, yes, I would say this is a character I understand well, and that in another life I could be, but that in this life I'm not her. I think that's about the best I can do with
that. Would wish fulfillment be a proper phrase?
I think that's probably part of it, not a huge part, because when one writes a wish-fulfilling character, that character is very often two-dimensional. I see a lot of that in fiction that I read of students, you know, that they wish to create a character and they have the idea of the character, and then somehow that character feels painted onto the page but not too well. It's a problem.
Lynn, I'd like to ask you if you could to please read a portion of The Mirror for us.
I'll read a bit where Agnes is leaving her husband and small child, temporarily anyway. The child's name is Leah, and the husband is the newspaper man, to go off and visit her lover, who is a hunter and lives inland in southern Africa, north of South Africa, probably in what was Rhodesia. And she's off on a train. It was a tiring journey, 3 days in the heat, switching and changing and showing my papers for stamping. But it was lovely, too, stopping at the little towns and then the plains of yellow grass and the umbrella trees and the mountains blue in the distance. After a while, there were even animals to see, zebras and antelopes and giraffes with their babies, all looking up as we passed as if we were interrupting their tea. And every now and then the native children would come running from their kraals and dance next to the train, holding out their hands for sweets. I had a coupe to myself all the way, and all the time in the world to think of where I was going, what I was leaving behind. And the funny thing was, now that I was going to see the hunter, I wasn't at all sure I wanted him. And so what was the point of the journey? To punish the newspaper man for things he'd said to me in anger, all of which were true? Truly, it was Leah who was punished, and by mistake too, and when I thought of this I was sad all over again, marooned in my coupe moving north through this vast continent, because I was willful and adventurous, and I wouldn't give up what I wanted. And then at last I arrived, and there he was, waiting on the platform, which wasn't even a platform, but a mound to step down onto. By now I was mad for him to make sense of the journey, for me to grab me up and tell me things I'd never thought of that way before. But instead he was saying, "Did you not receive my telegram, and perhaps you aren't aware?" And by the time I was loaded with my things into his jalopy, I was full of pity for myself, and close to tears too, which is the thing I knew he hated in a woman. They were to be 2 nights and a day together, said he, as we bumped along, and then he'd have to be off for a fortnight. And no, he couldn't take me with him. What was I thinking? I'd have to stay in the house with the servants, but it was no place for a white woman, and no place for a holiday either. I just sat beside him, hanging on to the strap with both hands, because the road wasn't a road at all, just tracks in the dust, and not once had he touched me except to hand me up into the jalopy, and I didn't need his warnings about white women and so forth to know that he didn't want me there at all. I was his girl at the port, 2 or 3 times a year, and I felt stupid now for the distance I'd travelled and all the letters I'd sent, the things I'd thought he'd want to hear about me. "Are you cross?" said he, smiling at last, a hand coming over to take mine. But I didn't like this either, the smile brought on by my setting myself against him. And so I told him this, and loudly too, and it was then that he laughed and stopped the jalopy and pulled me over to him. I didn't pout, that was never my way, but even though it was lovely to have the smell of him again and the bitter taste of his tobacco, still I was calculating when the next ship would sail south from Beira, thinking I'd plumb for that. It would be a lovely way to go back. It was sundown when we arrived at his house, with a great hallooing and the natives running out to stare at me. One woman stood apart with a half-breed child strapped to her back and another standing at her side. He said something to her in her language, and she stepped forward, looking down at the ground. I knew then that the children must be his, and the mother suffering to see me. She was very black and smooth, with gleaming, round, full breasts, and a beaded cloth tied round her hips, and the thought of them together filled me with longing. He must have known this, because he took me inside, had everything off me at once, even the pins out of my hair. It was dark in the house, hardly a house at all, really. Just two rooms and a roof made with mud and wooden poles and thatching. It smelled of earth and animal skins and the primus and his tobacco. He hooked up the cloths that closed off the bedroom from the veranda, letting in the last of the afternoon light. Come, said he, leading me naked out onto the veranda and pointing to a watering hole down the hill, the animals coming in to drink, this kind and that kind, which I pretended to see, but all I could think of was him behind me, breathing on my hair, the salt of his arm when I licked it, and how two things could be felt at once, one for this night and the next, and the other for my future without him in it.
Let me take a moment and say that we're talking today with Lynn Freed, the author of a novel called The Mirror, a portion of which she just read. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Lynn, the half-breed child, comes to Durban later in Agnes's life,
right,
and finds her.
Right. The hunter goes off to fight in the Second World War and clearly is killed in the Second World War, though this happens off stage. But he leaves a note with his woman or wife in the bush to say that if he doesn't return, to send this boy to find Agnes, which is what happens. And the boy does come, but he's wretchedly homesick, and the presumption by Agnes, which in fact seems to happen, is that when he's spent enough time being homesick, he'll go back to the bush.
Lynn, tell us about yourself, your experience in growing up in South Africa in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s.
Well, I think any country that one grows up in, however strange and odd, which South Africa certainly was in many aspects, seems at the time to be normal to one, even though one is told or one reads in the newspapers that this kind of normalcy is not acceptable either to oneself or to the world. I grew up in a family of liberal, at least liberal-claiming Jews. I went to a British girls' boarding school, although I wasn't a boarder. My parents were actors, and my mother had a theatre school. My father and many of the other actors had other jobs. My father ran his father's business, but he was an actor. He had been in the Cambridge Players in England, and my mother had been at RADA. And then they went back to South Africa after they were finished their students were in theatre all their lives.
Your parents were natives of South Africa?
They were both born there. My father of English parents and my mother of Russian parents. So yes, they were both first-generation South Africans. And so I grew up in a rather peculiar household, not typical. We lived in a huge old house, 20-room mansion, that my father had grown up in. And they were always off to the theatre at night, and there was always much drama on the home front as well as on the stage. I was the youngest of three girls, quite much the youngest, and so happily for me, rather left to be free. And so I ran around a lot. It was a rather free childhood. I was unsupervised, except for school and the usual things. And I had... Most childhoods are fraught with various things, but I think within that, given that, I had rather a fine childhood.
What was the drama that you refer to in your home?
Oh, there was always fighting and shouting and all sorts of noise. My parents were both quite dramatic, and if things were not lively enough, then they would make them lively by fighting with each other. And that we were always fighting with each other. it was, and then there were five servants who were in and out, and there was always drama around that. Actually, my second published novel is a very much fictionalized version of that. It's called Home Ground, and it's about just such a family. somewhat, rather a lot fictionalized.
At some point, you left South Africa and traveled extensively around the world.
Well, what I did was I left South Africa when I finished my basic degree and came to America as a graduate student, got married very early, had a child quite young, and then was teaching for a while and just desperate for a life of my own. And so what I did was stop teaching. I was teaching in the university, and I became a travel agent. And under that guise, and I was also started writing novels. I wrote three novels while I was doing this. For 10 years, I used to take off and go and travel on my own, all over the places that I wanted to go to. Egypt, South America a lot, parts of Africa, at least parts of Southern Africa, and Europe, which I had to that point not seen. And I liked to travel on my own. And I did so quite extensively. So that's how it happened. But it wasn't as a girl. It was really as a young mother that I was doing this, rather frowned on by a lot of people. But anyway, I'm not sorry.
Taking your children with you?
No, I only have one child. I sometimes would take her with me, and I often would send her from when she was about 6 years old. She was flying on her own. All over the world. I'd send her to South Africa and then pick her up there, or they'd send her to meet me in London. She was quite independent, and although she didn't love it when I would take off, she adjusted to it. Children are remarkable.
As you said earlier, when you grow up in a place, you don't know it's different from anywhere else.
Right, I found out. And I would go back to South Africa a lot. It's a country that I love and have always loved, I'm talking about the physical aspect and the people I know there, and it's home to me, and it, for some reason, it's the country of my imagination.
Tell us, if you would, about the changes and your interpretation of the changes that are going on in South Africa now.
Well, I'm really not qualified to comment on the changes in any but a rather interested observing way, because I've been out of that country living for 30 years, although, of course, as I said, it's my country. I think changes are remarkable, wonderful, the most wonderful thing that one could hope for. I grew up all my childhood expecting a revolution any minute. I mean, it was the horror of childhood, living under the cloud of the Holocaust and then growing up with the terror of a revolution.
You speak of the revolution of the blacks against the whites.
I and my family and everybody that I knew fully expected that one day this would happen, and it should happen. We just didn't particularly want to be wrapped up in the middle of it.
Well, being a member of a liberal family, what sort of discussion or what sort of ideas were there in your home that would affect the potential revolution that you speak of?
Well, I don't want to overplay the liberal hand. I mean, these were people who were liberal by association. They disapproved of the government, and they were vociferous about this, as were most of the people that I associated with and that they associated with. But the political discussions around the dinner table or in the home were so rare and of such a primitive order that I don't really think they would be worthy of talking about. My parents were deeply uninterested in politics. It was as if, really, it was just a nuisance out there and a bad thing and tut-tut-tut, but on went life. So really, they were not sophisticated in their opinions, by no means. And they were just slightly less blind than most South African whites at the time to what was going on, but only slightly.
When they escaped the pogroms of the Jews around the turn of the century, which I presume is what caused them to flee, did they bring with them a substantive Jewish heritage?
Well, to answer the first part of the question, my parents themselves did not flee at all. And in fact,
my mother's parents
left under those kinds of circumstances. My father's parents were already in England and had been for a couple of generations. So they were not, whatever they fled when they fled, it was not the late 19th century pogroms. But my parents both grew up in extremely observant Jewish families, and so did I. My parents were, oddly enough, I mean, so much about my upbringing was anomalous, but they were extremely identified Jews. We were sent to Hebrew school 3 times a week. We were sent to synagogue once a week. All the holidays were observed. And they, most of the South Africans when I was growing up were by affiliation Orthodox Jews, and probably still are. I'm not sure of that, though. So we were too. But then that was one side with a vast family who would meet every Friday night. I was never allowed out on a Friday night. They didn't keep kosher, which was considered an amazing thing by their families, but then after a while, their generation of families followed suit. So there was that, the Jewish side of things, and then there was their theater work, which took them into a totally other world of people, and so there were these sort of two areas of their lives which didn't have much to do with each other, in fact had nothing to do with each other, but were equally important to them. And so we grew up in those, with those two different aspects. They were very much Anglo-Jews within the South African context, both of them having spent time in England, especially my father, who had gone to boarding school in England, to public school.
And whose parents were English?
Parents were English, yes.
Certainly. Mm. Well, Lynn, what are you working on now in your home in Northern California?
Well, I'm at the moment at the beginning of a book, and I find it extremely difficult to talk about what I'm writing before I really know it. So it's a book of nonfiction, actually, a memoir. But more than that, I can't really say because I'm still finding out. But I do a lot of short stories, not a lot. I write short stories. I write whatever comes to hand, to the imagination's hand, should I say.
Well, Lynn Fried, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you the question I ask all of my guests. And that is, could you please tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
Let me think of that. What have I read lately? I go blank when I'm asked that. I'm so sorry. What am I reading? I'm reading Jonathan Yardley's Misfit, which is it's a wonderful biography of Frederick Exley. And I'm reading George Orwell's essays. I tend to read several books at once, and I'm reading a wonderful book by Graham Boynton called Last Days in Cloud Cuckoo Land about the end of white rule in Rhodesia. So that's three.
Well, Lynn Fried, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Lynn Fried is the author of The Mirror, the story of Agnes LaGrange. The books that she recommends are Misfit by Jonathan Yardley, Essays by George Orwell, and The Last Days in Cloud Cuckoo Land Dispatches by Graham Boynton. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.